piece of advice that I hear a lot is learn the business. That's hard because no one wants to. You become a writer because you want to write, not because you want to market and get in social media and all that other stuff. I personally really don't like social media, but you got to learn the business. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to sell your rights, and how mm-hmm. are you structuring your business? Like, mm-hmm. do you have an LLC? Do you have an S corp? What are you doing for tax purposes? These are the really mm-hmm. incredibly boring and obnoxious questions that will make a difference in whether or not you can afford to do this full time ever, or
yeah.
whether or not you make break even or make a profit.
This is the Crit RPG Podcast, your one-stop shop for everything Lit RPG, Progression Fantasy, and Royal Road. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Crit RPG Podcast, the only podcast where numbers go up, but maybe not in that way. With me today is Zach Pike, who writes Orconomics, a book about numbers going up, but more like in a, you know, like economical way, but with orcs. So we have decided it is officially a progression fantasy now, and this qualifies him for being here. Also, he's a really funny guy, and he laughs at my jokes, and I need the validation. So, hi, Zach, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Okay, good. Yeah. Fair warning for everyone who's listening and or watching. There might be some stone cold puns in this one because, we were talking about like Granite City Comic Con, and I can't be stopped.
Hello from the Granite State. Yep.
Yeah. I think I'm going to repeat this one because it's good for the main podcast because they should be taking the puns for granted. It's a really good pun. Rock solid. Anyway, talk to me about Orconomics. Sure. Why that book? How that book? And wherefore?
So I have been inspired by Terry Pratchett since I was young. I really loved his work, and I loved fantasy humor in a way that no other genre has really sparked my interest. And so I have been writing a fantasy humor story since high school. In about 2008, I got laid off as part of the big housing crisis that we had. Oh, yeah. And I had never really paid much attention to economics. I'm not trained in it, schooled in it. I don't think I even took a high school course in it. And all I knew about it was that people thought it was boring. But when it cost me my job, I took an interest and I started listening to podcasts and radio programs and then reading books. And it was just way, way more interesting than I had anticipated. Mm-hmm. And I started, whenever I get interested in something, I start to make fun of it. I start to make jokes about it. And so I realized this was the angle I wanted to take my book. So I took this story that I had been working and reworking forever, and I rewrote it to incorporate a more economic angle. That was 10 years ago, actually, on October 1st. And so it was that I published Orconomics. It's been a long time.
Well,
but I slowly published the trilogy, and it's now complete, and mm-hmm. I'm writing full time at this point.
Ooh, nice. Writing a complete trilogy. Nice. No, I do want to talk about your next project at some point. But I would also want to, like, everyone who hasn't read Orconomics, just briefly tell them what it's about.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So Orconomics is like, I pitch it as it's the Lord of the Rings meets the Big Short. It's about a dwarven ex-hero in the world. The economy is based on professional heroics, because if you could really make a ton of money just by going out and murdering a monster and getting huge heaps of gold, I figured investment banks would want in on that hot action. Yeah. So all professional heroes are backed by big banks and investors, and the hordes of monsters are claimed and bought and divvied up before the monster is killed, and then it's just a matter of the professionals going out to kill it.
Yeah.
And the main character did this for a long time, but fell into disgrace, and he's kind of a wandering drunken vagabond, and he meets a goblin, and he doesn't particularly want to kill the goblin, but he doesn't particularly not want to kill the goblin. He's just annoyed by it, and at a certain point he realizes he has more in common with that goblin than he thought, and he makes a decision to help it, and a lot changes based on that.
Oh, that's awesome. It sounds like a kind of wholesome story. Kind of.
Yeah. So I think it's it's a weird mishmash of things. There is some. It is not cozy. I'll say that. A lot of people really enjoy that it has a few big twists. Some people are a little surprised by the big twists, but it's a satire. It makes fun of the current super capitalist state of my country and the way we run things and stuff like that.
It's, this is not a political podcast, so I will not make any comments about the state of the world. But people who have been listening to my Patreon content know my emotions about this, so I'm not going to repeat them. I'm not a communist, just saying.
Okay.
Say no to communism. The point is, okay, so going back, we talked about this, right? I think we briefly on Discord, we chatted about the idea of, like, I also write a book that's kind of like economy based a little bit, but it's more like, you know, like the personal explorations of the youth in a society that basically wants you to, you know, be productive and kind of like live your life for productivity and what do you want. But yeah, so what's the next one? Is it about the logical succession would be, you know, like a completely barren world, ruined with like lots of ecological, like disasters going on the entire time. And people are like, you know, sitting around the campfire going like, but for a moment in time, we created great value for our shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Okay, so it's not a political podcast, so I'm not gonna go too deep into it. Yeah. I will say I'm not communist either. Mm-hmm. I think capitalism can do great things with proper regulation, but without it, when you have unchecked entities, their motive is clear. And what I don't think is clear is what happens next. I think we can imagine a lot of doomsday scenarios. And we can imagine some not so doomsday scenarios. And I take hope in the fact that, like, if you flash back in time 80 years, it was easy to imagine a lot of doomsday scenarios.
Yeah. And,
It wasn't.
I live in Berlin. You don't need to tell me.
Yeah, right. You know, it was a great time, and a lot of horrible things happened. But we had times after that, right? We persist. Yeah. So
let me clarify.
Yeah.
Because I have misled you. Yeah. I meant to ask the question about, like, what's your next series? But but then I threw you this curveball and you picked it up and went with it. So,
I did.
I
did.
You've activated my trap card.
So, yeah. It's not dystopian. That's where I was going with that. My next book, I'm working on a standalone. It follows one of the same characters, but it's not in the same story arc. It's called Cryptocurrency. So you can probably guess what it's
called. Nice. Have you read The Craft Sequence by Max Gladstone?
I have not.
You need to read that.
Okay.
It's post-capitalism, like late-stage capitalism, re-envisioned as a soul-siphoning necrocracy.
Oh, wow.
So, like, you have like undead lawyers who use the power of souls to argue against the rules of the universe. Like, there's one particular scene that always sticks in my mind where, like, a god has placed like a no-flight edict over a city, but a lawyer raises into the sky by arguing that hovering 2 meters over the ground is not flight. So, right? And these like super rich lawyers, they're all like immortal. They're all like liches because they have contracts that state that they have to be alive in order to like do something else. It is insane. And it's like, it's not a comedy, but you were talking about like great prose, right? Max Gladstone is on the same level as Patrick Rothfuss for sure. Like, he is really, really good. Sometimes the story gets a bit like get lost in the prose, but I do think that he's telling really great stories that are definitely readable.
That is right up my alley. I have the lawyer monks eventual in my books who are pretty good at binding reality with their contracts and stuff like that.
That's awesome. I gotta read on. I've prepared for this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now people will probably know this. Like, there's no way I can read like a book a week and also like write and also have like, you know, a normal job and also, you know, like do all the agent shit. So what I do is I interview authors and let them tell me about their stories, because that's even more interesting to me, because I love talking to authors, right? So you're talking about cryptocurrency.
Tell me more about it. So cryptocurrency is essentially a book where...
Wait. Is that about what I think it is about? Holy shit. Sorry. Go ahead. I just got that.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So yeah, on my world, shortly after the end of the last book, the rise of the Aethernet happens, and astralists can send information through the astral plane, and they devise a way to send money through it, and then they devise their own currencies, which rely on the specters of dead people. But it is definitely not necromancy. It is not necromancy, and the people who are making it are very clear that it is not necromancy, and there's nothing to be concerned about. And so the story follows one of my main characters who is high up in the Heroes Guild, and he gets called in on a case, and he has to establish what's going wrong with the cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And then it's also, because I never write in one genre, it's also got a little bit of maybe a rom-com feel. Because we explore where little dwarves come from. In my books, all dwarves are men. And and it's not one of those ones where the ladies are bearded, which is a very cool direction.
That happens in Beers and Beards.
Right. Terry Pratchett as well. But no, in my books, all dwarves are male. Mm-hmm. And they are really, really reluctant to talk about anything related to where that any of that stuff. They don't want to talk about it for anyone ever. And so as far as most people are concerned, dwarves are just hanging out, and then once in a while one of them shows up with a little bearded baby on his back, and nobody really knows except the dwarves.
Is this one of those things where they're all really good friends?
Nope.
Okay.
But so we talk about the book spends a surprising amount of time talking about, you know, like where little dwarves come from and how that gets arranged, and it's been a mystery in my world for three books,
which is something I love. I love it when people are like obviously raising this question and like lampshading it for like several books and then just like blatantly not answering it. Love that stuff. Love it. Like you're like the whole fantasy comedy thing gives me a real big flashback to a story I read like years ago. I don't know if you know it. It's called The Paladin Caper. It's a fantasy comedy about a group of, well, a group party of people who just like flicking your arm.
I have a child who wandered down the stairs to get me, and that was my subtle
begone good gesture.
Do not talk to me right now. Yeah. I tried to not interrupt this podcast.
No, it's fine. Like, this podcast has no cohesion whatsoever. So Paladin Caper, really cool book. Like, it's old now, and it never really sold all that well, but I liked it. There's a piece about a unicorn who really wants a virgin. Like, that's their entire thing. They need that virgin. And they're getting like this like 18-year-old boy who's like, you know, like just got like out of like bumfuck nowhere, and it's like, oh, a virgin. He's like, yeah. it gets cleared up in the end. Like, it's not as like creepy as it sounds, but anyway. Okay. Well, cool. So what's the best advice you've ever gotten as a writer?
Best advice. Man, I'm totally unprepared for this question, even though you sent it to me 3 days ago.
That is perfectly well. Look, have I read a shit ton of your books? No, I have not. Have you read my questions? No, you have not. Is there a disparity in the length of our tasks? A little bit. But who wants to talk about that?
Let's see. I think a couple of pieces of advice that I could not, I can't claim they've been given to me, but I've read them, I've looked at them, are, you know, write every day. You know, that's the key one.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone says that. But okay, yeah. Now everyone says just write. But write every day is specific. I like that better. Go ahead, though. Mm-hmm.
The reason I think people have switched to just write is that some people have said something to the effect of, writing every day doesn't work for me because of my life situation, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I write when I need to, and and it works for me. And more power to you if you're like that. But if you're one of those people who's like, I just can't get writing to stick, start with trying to write every day. And if you try to write every day and you find out, well, on Tuesdays I have 80 bajillion things, so I don't write on Tuesdays, but you're writing 6 days a week, good for you. You're writing 6 days a week and keep on doing that. That's
what works. So I mean, yeah. There's two things that always come to mind when people talk about this, because the people are like, I don't have time every day. Pardon? Neil Gaiman wrote Coraline 20 words a day before going to bed. Toni Morrison wrote Beloved in half an hour before she went to bed after, like, you know, like feeding her three kids and working two shifts. Mm-hmm. Right? So, I'm not going to be the hard ass and say, like, that's not an excuse. What I'm saying is that there's power in building a routine where every day you just write like just 10 words. And that's not like whatever that voice in your head is telling you, like, that's not pathetic or like bad or whatever. That is discipline. 10 words a day is discipline. Just don't break that chain. And you will find that most of the time, it will not stay 10 words.
So I think I think that was great advice for me. I don't actually write every day. I write most days. Mm-hmm. But, you know, by putting that focus on, like, you can find time, you can do this. Don't be so stuck on, like, I don't have a 4-hour block, so how could I possibly?
Yeah.
That, you know, that is really helpful. I think the other piece of advice that I hear a lot is learn the business. That's hard. Because no one wants to. You become a writer because you want to write, not because you want to market and get in social media and all that other stuff. I personally really don't like social media, but you got to learn the business.
I mean, like, yeah, you do. And I mean, like, obviously I can't sit here and go like, or just get an agent. But like, no, like, to be honest, I would prefer it if the indie publishing scene stays the way it is. There are publishers that you can approach, you know, who will take your stuff. Like, I know, for example, like right now, like Aethon is looking, Moonquill is looking, Podium is looking, right? And so is like the Legion publishers. You can look at all the publisher profiles on my podcast. I have a special podcast list just for it called the Pub Crawl, and they will take a lot of the work from you. But if you are good at social media and you're like good at engaging with people on social media, you will always sell more books, because it's just, yeah, you need to get good at it.
And you know what? That's just one aspect. Mm-hmm. That's marketing, right? Like, you have to do that even if you have a publisher, but like, what does it mean to sell your rights, and how are you structuring your business? Like, do you have an LLC? Do you have an S corp? What are you doing for tax purposes? These are the really incredibly boring and obnoxious questions that will make a difference in whether or not you can afford to do this full time ever, or whether or not you break even or make a profit.
And also, contract negotiation. That's like a really big skill, right? Because there's a whole world out there of like rights and negotiations that you probably don't know about. Like, for example, why would you sell any rights that aren't guaranteed to be used, right? So why would you sell your comic rights if the people don't want to use them? I mean, sure, it's a bet. Like, hey, sure, this thing might get big, right? But if you do, then ask what you will get for those comic rights if your book gets big, right? Because like, you might not want to take that deal. Like some publishers go like, you get 50% of all of what we make. But in the end, the publisher in that case is just an agent because they're going to sell your comic rights somewhere else. And then you take like 20% of what that other party does and then split that 50-50 with you. So you get 10%, right? For the publisher not having done that much work, I'm not saying nothing because many publishers do like put energy and time into, you know, rising your career up or what I say, like really editing your books, like really hardcore editing a book and putting money and time into it. But you need to know all this stuff before you sign.
Yep. So those were the pieces of advice I got that were very good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. I mean, in the end, I would love to draw it all longer because it's a topic I really like. But in the end, yeah. We can move on to the next one. What is one thing that you learned or that occurred to you while writing that you would either go back to and change or will not do again or will change in your future books?
Are we talking craft? Like just in terms of...
I'm a coach. I keep the question very open.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me see. One thing that I learned while writing that I will not do again. I have tried to pants a couple of times, you know, the pants versus the thing. And I will not do it anymore. I, even with a big outline, I suffer from analysis paralysis where I'm going to, my drafting especially can just grind to a halt. And, you know, really when you're doing your first draft, you should just try to get as much as you can down on the page. That's really challenging for me. And I've just learned that if I don't know where I'm going and I don't know how it fits together, I am not going to be fast in that phase. It's going to be incredibly slow and to the point of being counterproductive sometimes.
Yeah.
So I plot. That's the one thing I've learned. I am a plotter.
There's have you read 5K to 10? No, 2K to 10K? It's a book that people recommend a lot in writing circles.
Okay.
Have you not?
No.
It's it talks about this parenthetically. Because the book is about like, hey, how do you get to like writing 10,000 words a day? Like how is that possible? The author she wrote like The Legend of Eli Monpress, which I really enjoyed actually. Like I read that like a long time ago. Got it via like some sort of like a blog that I looked up for writing course in college. Like it was really interesting trajectory. Anyway, and she says like one of the biggest things that will slow you down while writing is exactly what you said, and that is not knowing what the fuck is going on next.
Right.
So whenever you're sitting there going like, what's going, like why can't I write? It's mostly because you don't know what's going on next. And I have this theory of like friction. Like basically like the mental load and then the surface of the story. And if the mental load is too high, then the sled won't go forward. So you need to like unburden that by taking away some fear, by taking away from uncertainty, or by reconnecting with what you want the story to be in the beginning, right?
I think on that last one, it's not just unburdening yourself. It's also like putting on some rocket fuel. Because when you're excited... about what comes next. You write faster. When you're excited, I can't wait to get to this part. Oh, this is the part I've been waiting to write. You write so much faster.
Oh God, yeah. I have this one thing right now. I'm like, I just plotted this today and was like, holy shit, that's going to be so cool. That's going to be so cool. But now I just need to like write the thing. I personally tried plotting first and I just got like, but I think that was mostly because nothing really fit. Because I plotted like didn't plot thoroughly enough, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I was like, this character has no motivation to do this. What the fuck am I doing here?
Right.
So
I think when I thought of plotting as outlining, I would be like, I'm outlining my book. Outline implies that it should be short and fast. And it shouldn't. You know, like, well, I shouldn't say shouldn't. For me, it shouldn't. Because it's basically the first draft. It's basically where I do the hard work of thinking what motivates this character. Why are they moving to this point? Mm-hmm. What, you know, what's going to be the conflict? What emotions does this raise? Mm-hmm. And as soon as I stop thinking about this as like an outline, and I actually use a program called Notion now, and I have like databases of scenes and details and stuff like that. Nice. And, you know, so I can tie everything together. Once you start thinking about it that way, as like, I'm really going to get the meat of the story down. So it's like a sand sculpture, right? You're at the point where you're just piling it all up. And of course, you're going to do some shaping and things will change and it'll look different when you're done.
Yeah.
But you've got to get a lot of material out and see how it's going to start to come together. Then, yeah, outlining is super valuable as a crappy first draft. Mm. And also takes a really long time. You can't rush it.
It's to be honest, so I don't know how much you know about writing in the lit RPG space. Actually, how much do you know about it?
I don't know very much.
Okay.
I've recently started listening to Dungeon Crawl at Carl. I'm 6 books in. It is fantastic. We talked about that in the
early stuff. And his writing process,
And his writing process. Mm-hmm. I love Dungeon Crawl at Carl. Unequivocally, I have only ever attempted two other full lit RPG books, and I did not finish them. And like, that's not to say they're bad. I don't finish a lot of good books, but if I'm not really into a book, I don't finish it. Whatever it was about them, they didn't grab me, and I had kind of at that point said like, this may not be my genre.
No, it's okay. Like that's like perfectly fine, right? It is a certain acquired flavor. I think I won't be like burned at the stake if I say this, but Dungeon Crawler Carl is very much an outlier when it comes to lit RPG because it is so well crafted. Right. Many of these other books are not. That doesn't mean they're bad. They just give you a different flavor.
There are genre readers who want to experience a genre and they love that genre.
Yeah.
And they have opinions about which is better and which isn't quite as good, but they, you know, they love it all. I'm not a genre reader. It's not like fantasy humor is my jam. I have DNF'd a lot of fantasy humor books because just because it's in my genre doesn't mean I'm going to read it. And the same goes for epic fantasy, which I also love. And I've discovered now it's you know, like lit RPG it's just another genre. I'm not the sort of reader who says, because you've hit my tropes, I'm going to read this. But if it's a good story, you know, the tropes become something that's in service of that story and it can be quite enjoyable.
How are you on swearing and or Shakespearean insult comedy?
Wow. that took a left turn. I don't have swears in my book, but I... I make my own swears. It's not.
No, I mean, in general, do you enjoy this? This is me trying to like see if I can recommend something to you.
I'm fine reading it. I'm absolutely fine reading it. Doesn't make a difference. I just don't. I don't write it for whatever reason.
You might enjoy Media Maker. It's written by my dear friend Seth McDuffie and his dear friend Jonathan McLean, who's also a narrator. And I thought it was really, really good, right? It has that Seth MacDuffie tone to it. I also wanted to recommend to you Big Sneaky Barbarian. I think this has like the kind of like theme that you also would like. It's about a very, very angry boy getting reincarnated as a orc. And then through the tribulations, he gets like really, really good at sneaking. Like he's an orc barbarian, but he's like super sneaky. It's wild. It's kind of like it jumps from scene to scene and like this, it kind of like goes through there like a pearl string. But what really sells you on it, like, is the humor. So if you love that sort of like, if you love people using very, very creative insults on other people, that's like Seth MacDuffie is the person for you for 100%. And Media Maker is more of that, but tempered in the fires of Jonathan McClane's plotting. So it's really good.
Excellent. Is it Media Maker?
Meteor Maker up there.
That Meteor book. Maker.
Meteor Maker, it's about an author who gets isekai'd into his own fantasy world, which, yeah. He's a pantser, and that's right. A problem because he barely remembers what he wrote like 2 days ago. So and now he has to like remember what was my plot, and he has to like act as though he's like the main character. Everyone's like, you've changed. You're really different. It's like, yeah, sure. Just for reasons. It's good. It's really, really good. And yeah, and Jonathan McClane also reads it. It comes out like I think in a couple of days. I think in like October. So I can recommend it. It's really good.
Awesome. Yeah.
But going back to plotting and pantsing, I want to talk about your real process, because you've mentioned like outlining and plotting and the difference between the two of them, but like take me through your process. Like what do you do in like a given year?
Okay. So I'm gonna caveat everything with just a reminder that I wrote part-time, mostly between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. for a decade. And that is not conducive to having a process. That's, you know, closer to that, like, I'm going to get down 20 words. So I'd have an outline, and there were, what I found was, like, my third book was probably delayed a good 8 months because I hit a point where the outline wasn't sufficient. Mm-hmm. And I rewrote and went back, and then there's just some kind of despair, which leads to gaps in the writing schedule and stuff like that. So I really, when I said I'm going to do this full time...
We're experiencing emotional difficulties.
Exactly. So when I went full time just this summer, I was pretty determined to have an excellent outline. I found there's a company called Storyflint that does a Notion template for world building Bibles, and they include some outlining stuff. What I love about Notion is just, it's really like a note-taking / database / knowledge store software, and it can be used for anything. And then people can make their own templates. And so because of that, like I track everything in Notion right now, all my business stuff and everything like that. But I also, you know, like could modify the heck out of the template I bought. So it was an amazing start. There was some stuff I wanted to do differently. And anytime I think of something new that I want to track, I can just kind of throw it in and, you know, it's not like I'm going to request this in the software. If you know a little bit about using Excel, you can figure out how to make it happen in Notion. So, there's my little, I'm not an affiliate. I don't get anything if you buy it, but there's my little pitch.
You should.
Just reach out to Storyflint. They do. I mean, like, the template was ridiculously cheap. It was like $60 or something, and it saved me dozens of hours of setup. So then within that, I can create basically entries for every scene, and I can create entries for the details. And that means I can connect a detail to more than one scene and say, this is where this detail is going to come up. I can start to say, like, these are the characters. They all have their own character sheets that are linked in. And that's been really, really valuable because for one thing, when I want to do a story arc, I can sit down and just make a big list of this is what happens here. This is what happens here. This is what happens here. And then I'm just plugging them in to the various scenes and seeing how they fit together. And just typing out an outline of each scene to say, here's where all these details will come in. And then also when the time comes to write it, all of these details and everything are all linked. So a lot of times I'll be like, how many people are in this statue? What's going on with this? And I, you know, with a couple of clicks, it's basically my own wiki to look around.
Awesome. So, I was thinking about using AI for that for a while because like you would pants everything and then you would like go back and like try to like read through it again. It's hard. Yeah.
AI is like having a really eager, really stupid intern.
Yeah.
Like somewhat talented, but just keeps on blitzing something out and be like, didn't I do a good job? And you're like, hey, you know, yeah. That's not what I asked for.
That's what the AI stands for. Ambitious intern.
Yes. It's crazy. And yeah. I mean, like, so I had to write a synopsis of my book for a pitch recently for cryptocurrency. And I had this incredible outline.
You know what time it is? That's right. It's a new ad. And this time I have two amazing stories for you to check out. First one is about a friend Saving Throw, who writes a story called So When Am I a Hero? It's a system apocalypse that is quite frankly amazing. I don't like system apocalypses usually, and I devoured that one. So go and check it out. There's a link below the podcast. The second one is from another friend of mine, because I have two friends, called The Infinity Dungeon by Reject Humanity. Premise is actually pretty cool. Guy goes hiking on the Appalachian trails and stumbles into the only and first dungeon in the world, and he's the only person on Earth with a system, at least for a while. All right, go check him out. I appreciate it a lot, and I'll see you next time.
So I, you know, like, super detailed. So I used Notion has AI features, and I was like, all right, I want you to outline this book. And it did, or write a synopsis of this outline is what I asked it for. Did, but it was wrong. Yeah, not like hallucination. Better, yeah. But like inserting characters.
Yeah.
And making up facts and doing things that, you know, again, for my world building made no sense. Again, when I'm talking about like dwarves, there are no female dwarves in my book. It just made a female dwarf and made her a major antagonist and included her all through the outline or the synopsis. And I was like, okay, I can't even use this as a basis. It's not like I was just going to submit an AI generated thing, but I thought I could get a decent skeleton, maybe see what a compelling synopsis might look like, and then massage it. And I just got something where I'm like, this is useless. I'm not so anti-AI that I'm like, never, ever touch it. I think it'd be better if it had never been built, but it has. And
it's the Physica all over again. Dürrenmatt, he's like a German author. He's deceased now. He wrote a play called The Physicists, The Physica. And it's about this physicist who's like built the almighty weapon, like in the 50s, right? 1950s. And he feared his weapon so much that he got himself like put into an insane asylum so that no one would take him seriously, right? So that no one would like look at his stuff and like find out the weapon. But then like two of the major countries also get like into the asylum and try and find out, like try to get the secret. But then in the end, it turns out that the asylum is actually being run by an insane person, and she takes the secrets and builds the weapon, and the three of them are like the only sane people in the entire asylum. And but the main point of it is like, if you have thought something, you cannot unthink it. So it is out there now, so it's going to happen whether we like it or not. Just we have to roll with the punches. But as I agree with you, it shouldn't have been. Like, no one should have taken autocorrect and went like, what would happen if we gave this thing crack? So,
I think, I mean, one thing is just on this, like, I see these debates about AI, and an argument that has thankfully faded that came out for a while was like, you shouldn't use technology to take away the fun jobs. And I understand the sentiment there. I just want to point out that, like, you know, the big super example that should come readily to mind of technology taking away jobs is the Industrial Revolution, when tons and tons of people lost farming jobs. And a lot of people like farming. Like, it's a lifestyle that appeals to a ton of folks. That's why right now it's kind of like a hobby for the rich. Like, Jon Stewart of The Daily Show could do it, you know? But, like, most people can't be a farmer, even though they'd really like to.
Yeah, because, like, you need, like, all sorts of machinery. Like, again, not a political podcast, but I think I would encourage people to actually think about, like, well, where's all that money going? If I'm not getting paid for farming, who is? Think about that. Like, the idea is, like, you were talking about the fun stuff, right? Let's say I'm a carriage driver in 19th century, like 18th century, sorry, 20th century, like early at the beginning. I had three of them, and the last one was right. And I like horses. That's why I became a cab driver. I love horses, right? And then people are building like the combustion motor, whatever that means. And now I have I can basically bring my horse to the glue factory and like get a car with like, you know, a motor in it. Right. But I did not become a cab driver because I like driving a motor car. I became a cab driver because I like horses. Same with riding, right? I like stringing words together. I don't necessarily like just the outlining process. I want to do the entire thing. And I don't want this to be a hobby that you can do once you're rich, because that means that I have to do my friggin', well, I like my job too, but I don't love it as much as writing. So at some point we're going to have to like have a real long think and look at ourselves and go like, if the only thing that you can do to earn money is compete for like a shrinking amount of jobs, something's got to give.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. And I think the thing is like, we're hearing it from the authors and the artists because it's happening to us, and we always thought it couldn't, but it's happened to so many other groups. And I don't hear, I didn't, you know, 5 years ago when people were talking about self-driving cars and how soon those might be coming, I didn't hear anyone being like, what about the people who enjoy being taxi drivers?
Or I did.
Oh, you did?
I did. Yeah. I said like, sorry to like ruin your argument there, but like the thing is like, I said like, hey, what about all the like truck drivers? They didn't become truck drivers because they thought like, oh, I'm sorry, but like, you know, building artificial like intelligent constructs with IT is like too boring for me. Like, they like what they're doing. Yeah. Right. So
I think there's two reasons to be a little bit hopeful on AI. One is, like I said, it's not very good. Like, the promise of it was insane. And for a while it came close enough that people were like, this is amazing. Yeah. Full disclosure, I use AI. I don't write with it, but I use it. I find it to be an incredibly useful Google engine, right? Yes. Where I'm tell me about Victorian era, you know, insults or something like that. And it will give me a good enough synopsis, not something I would put in a research paper, but I'm writing fantasy. Yeah. Who cares, right? I also use AI generated images
story Bible. Yeah.
Right. Because I'm like, I'm not going to pay an illustrator for personal illustrations, and I'm not really going to publish these anywhere. Like, I'll share a couple with my patrons in Discord once in a while, but it's just like, this is what I thought. And I'm not going to, you know, like,
otherwise you would have just like stolen stock images from the internet.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. It's how is it less ethical than going on and taking images that I have no rights to and putting them in there? So I think it's useless, and anyone who uses it is horrible. I do use it. I think that the product is not fit for consumption. It's not good, right? Yeah. Like, it doesn't create good things. And there's increasing evidence that there's not enough data to train it on to get it to a point where it is good. So there's hope there.
It's also starting to get mad cow disease because it's cannibalizing itself.
Right. Right. And so like there's hope that it's not going to be the big thing. The other thing I'd say is right now, it feels like a lot of folks' strategy is to shame people who do use AI and like, let's, you know, there's AI in that cover. Don't ever, you know, do it. And
you haven't been on Royal Road.
Okay. Yeah. I remember the SPFBO, somebody had a cover, and the author, you know, says he doesn't even know, and I choose to believe him, that his artist like used some AI elements in the cover. Okay, but the whole, you know, like, it used some AI elements, but it was an amazing cover, right? Like, and instead of shaming that person and being like, how dare you ever contribute money to Midjourney, I feel like we should be taking more of an a marketing standpoint, organic did for foods, right? Like, I'm not going to shame someone because they ate a bioengineered food. You got to, you know, you got to eat. It's cheaper. It's nutrients. I understand, but this is better. this is a better way. And I think, you know, like, instead of tearing down people who make use of a technology that's coming through, there's an opportunity to just talk about it. Like, you can have a real relationship with a real author. We're human beings you can talk to and meet at a con and interact with. And
I dislike the term outrage culture. It's not quite aptly named, I think. But I do think, like, the idea of, like, shaming someone immediately is dangerous. Because human connection works through empathy. Now, I'm not saying that if someone says, like, this group of people should all die, you could be like, hey, but do you want to talk about this? Like, that's what I'm talking about. But if I'm looking at it, like, let's say, like, someone has, like, an opinion about a certain topic, and that opinion is controversial to a certain other group, that other group shouldn't be like, oh, we will never talk to this other person again, because that way you will never convince them. What have you gained, right? What is going on here? Like, how does this help humanity? How does it help you? Because now there's a person you can no longer talk to, and they're not alone. They're going to band together with a bunch of other people, and then they're going to have a critical mass, and then suddenly Brexit.
Right.
Right. Or I don't know, like, you know, can look at what's happening in Germany right now, or the US, like, everywhere in the world.
100%.
Yeah. Harari has written a new book about this. It's interesting.
And the other thing I'd say that's, you know, important there is just recognize that most people don't write books.
Yes.
And most people don't create art. Not in a professional capacity. I say that without judgment. I say, right, they are just not this community, and they don't care as much right now. And if we turn it into a big bitter fight between two artists, you know, like,
nothing's gone, nothing's won.
Yeah. How do you market that? How do you, like, you know, like, pick a side, and they're like, I just want to read a book. I just want to look at a picture. I don't care, right?
Yeah.
But if we use the power of marketing to instead of make it about tearing down the people who use solutions that, you know, are kind of questionable, and instead make it about, like, look how good it is to support a real artist. Look how much more interesting the life story behind that is. You know, like, this is quality source. This is local, right? Like, why does buying local matter? Why does buying organic matter? Like, this is better, you know, and start lifting those things up. I think that's where, you know, like, we have a better chance of penetrating the full zeitgeist.
Written by a real human author.
It's coming.
But, like, I mean, if I'm selling books for, like, $100 bucks a copy for the rich people who can afford it, sure. But like, that's like a different kind of point. But, like, we're talking about, like, so many things, like, adjacent that I kind of also wanted to go into. We're talking about, for example, like, Railroad, and the, like, serialization of it, right? Because we started this entire thing by talking about plotting. The way you can't go back and edit a web serial like that, right? Because it's out there. I mean, you can, and I did do that, but in the end, it's really, really dumb, and you shouldn't be doing it. Because the people who have read on don't know what changed in the past, so you can't make any major changes anyway. Typos, sure, but nothing like that. Having everything pre-outlined is pretty good until you, like, start, like you in the third book, right? Start realizing, like, oh shit, this doesn't work. So I have my own idea about how to, like, solve that issue, but I would like to hear how you solved it.
Well, I'm not sure I have. I'm really clear that I'm not doing serialization. I am sharing my draft chapters with my patrons, but I don't post on Royal Road, and I'm not interested in an early release outside of that.
In particular, I meant, like, how did you solve the issue of, like, hey, the plots suddenly going, like, not working?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to, you know, that, in the past, I haven't solved it very well. Like, I lost 8 months. And now that it's full time, like, there's honestly, some of it's just the whole, like, you have to dedicate a block of time to it. You have to find 4 hours to sit down and really think through, like, what are my options? How do I take this forward? How do we you know, kind of push this through. I find it helpful to read some of the old story structure advice things. I'm actually, for a future series, going to do something fun with those. But like, you know, the save the cat, the three act structure, all of that. I think those things can be quite helpful. But I mean, serialization is its own beast. I think like one thing I noticed about Dungeon Crawler, Carl, I say this as someone who has just burned through six books. I don't normally read sequels. I've just burned through six books. So I can't express enough how much I respect this. It does feel sometimes what, you know, used to be called episodic, right? Yeah, like we'd say, and episodic used to be kind of like almost a little derogatory, you know, like,
really?
Like it's not a well-crafted full thing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, you know, like, so if a movie felt episodic, what people were saying is the third act doesn't really feel connected to the second. It doesn't feel connected to the third. It feels like I'm watching three episodes of a TV show instead of a cohesive thing. And again, I'm not saying that about Dungeon Carl, which maintains some super long story arcs, which are super cool. But you definitely note, like, this is the section where they're dealing with this problem, and then they go and deal with this problem, then they go and deal with this problem. And I think that's a structure, or that's a result of Royal Road and stuff, and people expecting more serialization and the rise in popularity of that stuff. And woe unto the author who doesn't pay attention to the fact that that is changing storytelling structure. Like at Dragon Con, I was talking to a pretty big editor, and we just happened to have this this reader walk by who was just hanging out. You know, that's one of the best about Dragon Con. We asked him a couple questions. He's like, "I don't really read books. I just like reading on Royal Road. I just like keeping up with several series." And you know, the editor was looking like she was going to go crazy, but like that was the thing. It's like I'm like, people's preferences are changing, and he does not care about the three act structure. He cares about keeping up with his series. Right. Like he's a different sort of reader.
And so it's getting increasingly more like difficult to get people to sit down to read a book over a weekend, because they're all you know, in school at lunch break, they like want to read a quick story, or in college or work. Right. You can literally see that Royal Road's usage spikes whenever it's lunch break or commute time on the West Coast and East Coast in the US. It's a completely different way of telling a story, because almost each little chapter has to be self-contained.
Right.
You also have to know how to cliff super well. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure if my books can do that well, or if I do it too well or whatever, right? I don't know if I like it. And I don't think that particularly it will take away readers from traditional stories as much as I think it will allow people who usually would have just watched anime or whatever, now allow them also to read.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And I think it's just a new way to, it's not genre, but it's a new format for reading. And it's so, you have to recognize that this change is happening, that this is coming, and ask yourself, how does this fit into multiple markets? And I mean, like, mad respect for those people who can write the serial, pull it together, put it into a very successful series, and like then market it as traditional books and stuff like that. Like,
there's only a few who did that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But and again, super talented, because you have to keep both of those things in balance and say, am I keeping my big arcs? Because I think if it was just, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think your serial readers, again, why would they pick up a book? And your book readers have different expectations. So if you can balance both of those and do them at the same time, that's awesome. I cannot. I'm writing, and I'm about to like gender swap one of the characters in my new books, because I realized like, oh, this guy needs to be a girl. And, you know, there's a massive retcon, right? Right? There's something that the on Royal Road would tolerate at all.
Especially female characters in my books now.
That too. But right, like, you know, like I need that freedom to go through an iterative process to produce the best product that I can. And I focus solely on what's this gonna look like in the end. I know other people who are doing both. They have some books they do that full focus, and then they have some more serial stuff, and again, totally respect it.
It's like, I think like the way that I'm trying to solve this, like, or square that circle, is I'm trying to like plot arcs. So yeah, it might be a bit like formulaic, or not formulaic, episodic, because literally like every arc has a certain thing, but then have like also overarching arcs, like that sort of stuff, might work or might not work. I still have to like sit down and really like plot it through, but also because I'm still like learning how to do it, there's like a lot of changes throughout the story. So like how the story is actually written, and I actually have been looking at the first book and I'm like, yeah, I'm doing the same thing three times.
Yeah.
And I need to kind of condense that. So how can I really get to the bottom of this? What is the book really about? That sort of stuff. And yeah. I will need at some point to go back and like do it again. And people are like actually like not, they're not laughing about me, but they're like looking at me with concern because I have been rewriting this book for like two times already. And I think that's how books have been written for like thousands of years.
That is the process of writing a novel, and serialization doesn't lend itself to it. And I think the warning I for any listeners who are writers, I think the warning is you need to really know yourself. Mm. I have so much respect for someone who can sit down and write a book. And I know a few people who do this. They just write a first draft. They send it to a copy editor and they're like, now it's done.
Yeah.
Right? Like a beta editor was...
Right? Everyone who has been on this podcast except for you. Like, really, literally, like, it's insane. Some people, like, my buddy Sean here, like, who wrote, like, Dawn of the Last Dragon Rider, he literally, like, has days where he, like, pounds out 18,000 words.
Right.
I represent an author who writes The Wandering Inn, and they famously once peaked at 180,000 words. 180,000 per week.
That's insane. And so look, Wandering In, hugely successful, right?
Yeah.
Good. I don't know the
good for them.
Yeah. Good for them.
Like, no one knows. Even I don't know. My agent partner does. I don't. So
good for them. So I mean, like, that's fantastic. And people can meet with a lot of success. But we also kind of alluded, there are a lot of books out there that are not great. And some of them are really bad. And I think some of those are the authors who cannot do that. And I'm not judging them. I am one of the authors who cannot sit down and have my first draft be published worthy. Mm. But if you think the standard is to just write it once and ship it out because you got to do serial, you know.
So what you're saying is it's more about the option of also doing the other thing, and that like serialization isn't the only thing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like they're different products. And yes, there's this exciting new market in serialization. Mm. And yes, there's new ways to make money. People still read books.
Mm.
People, you know, like that, it's not growing as fast because it started like people have been reading books for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. I don't know. Yeah. It's a super long time. And Royal Road and all of those exciting serialization options are very, very new. So awesome if you can take advantage.
Yeah, they are, and they're also not, right? So Sherlock Holmes used to be a serialized story, right? Like serialization in newspapers has been around for a long time. But what's new is that there are no gatekeepers, which is also why I'm like very, very like conscious of the fact that you shouldn't need an agent in this RPG space. I'm very, very happy about this. I don't want to change that because I want a space where everyone in theory can get published as long as the story is good enough. And I don't want to raise the bar to the point where like an 18-year-old kid who's written his first story that's like, it's actually pretty decent, can make a living off of it. I like that. But sometimes, like, that's my ego talking, right? Sometimes I'm like, wow, like, I can't believe this prose. Like, what the hell is going on here? They've been using the same word like five times in two paragraphs. Like, what is up? Right? But that's my ego talking. And people like it. And people buy it. And just because, like, I write something different that apparently less people like, doesn't mean that that thing is bad. That means that my thing also isn't bad. It just means that it's not hitting the same market.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there are gatekeepers. It's the hive mind is the gatekeeper, right? Like
yeah. But I mean, that's true for everything, right? So, right. Yeah, like, you can't, like, I think the one thing that trad publishing has to get over is the idea that they understand what the market wants. They clearly don't. There's a huge market of people who love Lit RPG in all its unfinished, unedited, jagged edges glory. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, this market must make more than 100 million a year. Like, probably way more than that.
Right.
And that's a huge market, right? No, it has to be billion. Like, it has to be more than that. Because I know a couple of authors who make like more than 10 million a year already. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they square it. Because on the one hand, I hear you. There's very clearly a market for that kind of rough and ready, mm-hmm. you know, just fun lit RPG. And mm-hmm. again, it's a different sort of product. Mm-hmm. There are people, Dungeon Carl, who can cross over and make it in traditional books. There are people who don't need to. They're going to be wildly successful, mm-hmm. you know, like on doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I will say, not in defense of trad publishing, but just like a kind of a positing it, mm-hmm. they make a lot of their money based on prestige.
Yeah.
Right. They are a prestige market, and it's about who they work with, and they work with Hillary Clinton and, you know, like, or whoever else, like, you know, they publish mm-hmm. books by people who are famous outside. They publish the biggest authors. Mm-hmm. A huge part of their strategy is to be prestigious.
I mean, and aren't you glad as an indie author that you don't need a vanity press anymore?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. But the flip side of that is like, I can see why they don't want to publish something that's like rough and ready. Like, even if they could make money, would it cost them anything? I don't know.
Yeah, the cost is definitely out there. Like, they're like, if you're really big enough, like, I think that's like one of the downsides is that there are some stories where I'm like, crap, this should be at Barnes & Noble. Like, for example, All the Skills. That's a really good book. That should be at Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. For sure. Like, I think Podium is going to release it next year. I don't know. Like, I hope they will. So I hope they're going to be like shipping it to like traditional like bookstores. Yeah, like, I really hope that they are going to, you know, not toss the kid out with the bathwater. Because, like, some of those books are, like, really, really good. And not just, like, the really big ones. So, yeah, of course, like, it's a no-brainer to, like, you know, do, like, a He Who Fights His Monsters book. Like yeah, sure, it makes sense. Like, next year, there's going to be, like, a huge... I think April is going to be huge because Ilona Andrews are releasing Lit RPG, right? That sort of stuff. So it's definitely coming to trad. But I hope that there is a market for authors who do not succeed in serialization because the book isn't structured this way, but instead can succeed in trad.
Right.
With all the pitfalls that has, like, you know, the whole like agent thing, the whole I am noticing it already, right? Like, I want to represent as many people as I can because I want to get them good deals. But A, I don't need to because all the publishers in this space are like actually pretty fucking decent. And then secondly, I just don't have the space. I have to be selective because otherwise I can't give my clients the same service that I want to give them.
Right.
So it's frustrating. To a certain degree, it's very frustrating because I want some people to like really get trad pubbed, but I don't. Thanks for listening. Yeah. All right, but we're talking about books so much. Let's talk about one book that you love and why is it awesome.
One book that I love and why is it? I think I've dropped a few already. The mm-hmm. one that comes most immediately to mind is Dungeon Crawler Carl, and I don't think I need to tell people why it's awesome, but I will just say I've enjoyed the heck.
Have
out
you
of
read
it.
Cradle?
I have not read Cradle.
I've been listening to it. It is very, very good.
I know how insanely popular it is, and
it's a meme. Yeah,
I was like, when I was at Dragon Con, I was like, oh, Will White's here, maybe I'll meet him. And they're like, he's got his own thing on the side, and I'm like, holy smokes, like the guy's huge. But, no, I haven't read it. I feel like I should try to highlight something that, man, I don't know. I did really, really enjoy Rage of Dragons and its sequel. I'm very much looking forward to Evan Winter finishing that series. And then I'm starting Andrea Stewart's The Gods Below, which so far has been really interesting. So that just came out, and I heard her pitch it at Dragon Con, and I've been checking that out. So so far that's really, really kind of cool, but I'm literally just getting started on that.
I think I mean, I also did some like books that I love. I think one more that would come to mind, it doesn't. I had one in the back of my mind while you were talking, and now I forgot it, but I think it's gonna be fine. But I am going to shout out my editor Jamie's podcast. It's called the Netflix Gaming Club, and he's talking about all the games you can play on Netflix, because Netflix actually has like a gaming subscription. People don't know. Lots of really cool indie games, and you can like play with your phone connected to your TV. It's really good. Lots of cool games like Rain, Spiritfarer, a bunch of others. Like, really cool games.
I'm gonna check it out.
And Jamie's podcast basically discusses all of them, and you can find out which ones you want. You can find it at bigbad.ca/ NFG, I think, or just look for Netflix Gaming Club. NFC, obviously, not NFG. Anyway, so last point for the main podcast: shoutouts.
What are shoutouts? I don't do a lot of podcasts. What am I supposed to do here?
See, people, this is what I get for inviting someone who is not on Royal Road. Shoutouts are the deep honor of bestowing your prestige onto some of your fellow authors. Basically, it's telling, like, saying hi or mentioning people that you think people should be aware of or that you are particularly like. Think of it a little bit like an acceptance speech. People are actually listening to it.
Okay. At this point, they might not be.
Oh, no, there they are. I have really good listen through on these. Like, it's really interesting.
What? Well, thank you, everyone. All right. So just shouting out some authors that I know and appreciate. I want to shout out Dirk Ashton, Paternus trilogy. I've read Paternus. It was excellent. I'm looking forward to finishing the trilogy. I saw him in a movie. He used to be an actor, and he's a very distinctive looking fellow. And I watch his series called Riff Tracks, which is it's like Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's some of the guys who used to do it, and they just make fun of movies. So I was watching one the other day, and he just showed up. So yeah, nice. Dirk, I'm telling that story. Shout out to Rob Hayes and ML Wong. So they did Where Loyalties Lie and The Sword of Kaigan, which are two really popular epic fantasy books. They won SPFBO, and because of that, they got bundled together on a Kickstarter that ends in a few days. And you can get these super special SPFBO winner editions that are kind of paired up. And it's being published by Wraithmark. So shout out to Bryce.
By the time this podcast is live, you will have missed your chance. So bad luck.
Oh my gosh! Well, a lot of times they'll do like a late backer store or something. So maybe
you have to get them. Wraithmark does that. Yeah, Wraithmark also, by the way, great publisher. Shout out to them.
Yep. Hey, Bryce. Shout out there. You should definitely go and back those because they're planning on continuing it with the other SPFBO winners.
You know what they say: the Bryce is right.
Do they say that?
Yes, I'm sure someone does. I mean, I just did.
I mean, he is right about a lot. But,
I mean, like, you know you can't put, I mean, you know you can't put a Bryce on good puns. Anyway, let's move on.
Can't on bad ones, though. Let's see.
You lost my reputation. Bryce will remember this. Oh, shit.
Oh, gosh. Who else? Shout out to Rachel Renner, who did an awesome panel I mentioned earlier with Jim Butcher and Stuart. She was super funny on that panel, and I've been talking to her a bit, so she's a great person. Shout out to Andy Pelican of the Dark Blade series. I got to spend a lot of time with him at Dragon Con, so that was pretty great. And
one more.
One more.
Oh, one more. There's one more.
Shout out to Matt Dinneman, who read my book.
My arch nemesis. Again. I have been foiled yet again. Okay, do you have any last words, Zach?
Are you about to kill me?
No. No one knows what happens in the Patreon con except for the Patreon. So I might. Or I might not. Subscribe. Sorry.
What? I would say you should definitely subscribe for the awesome Patreon content that's about to happen. It may or may not involve my name. And
I really appreciate you saying that. Don't you love it when, like, sometimes, like, just a few sentences will change your entire fate?
And then to be a horrible shill, I just say if you like fantasy, like tabletop RPGs, and you like funny things, and you have even a passing interest in how economics changes all of our lives, you should check out Orconomics and the rest of the Dark Profit Saga. That's Profit. Give it a shot.
Which is really funny. Like, in case you haven't noticed, this man is funny. So, yeah. Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, with that being said, thank you, everyone, for listening and watching. Like, subscribe, do the Patreon thing. You know, like, the drill by now. And if you don't, if it's been your first time, I'm very, very sorry. Love having you here. Thank you very much. Go check out some of the other podcasts. Episodes. With that being said, I think we're done. So, again, thank you, everyone, for listening and or watching. And I'll see you next time. And if you're on Patreon, the show goes on.